Alrighty. Good morning. Happy Tuesday morning. So this is a little unusual for me because I'm an engineer and I usually talk about geeky type of topics, normally engineering, risk-based. But for the last couple of years, I've been really stunned, especially post-COVID, about how many people just seem to be stuck. And stuck meaning they're not happy, they're not moving forwards, they seem to be wondering about the good old days and what happened. And the uncertainty, especially with AI, is just causing a lot of personal consternation or anxiety even. So anyway, I wrote a quick book on that. I'll share some of the thoughts I had in the book. So anyway, hopefully you'll enjoy it. Hopefully there'll be some downloads. But anyway, this is definitely a feel-good topic. So let's get into it. That's me, obviously. And this is some of the stuff that we do. We've been evangelizing that the future quality is risk for a bunch of years. And, right now, we're doing startups again, which I didn't think I would be doing at my age, but working lots of hours and, just simply reinventing myself in the world of AI safety. So anyway, let's sort of dive into this. We're going to cover these topics, maybe not in the sequential order, but we'll talk about them. First, signs of the times. There's a lot of things out there basically pointing to uncertainty being the new normal. I'm going to basically, pose some couple questions for you. Questions that were important 15 years ago, and now I'm going to basically post questions that I think are important right now. I'm going to basically address, how do you deal and how do I deal with uncertainty? How to decide, which is really important. Most of us have some type of mechanism, methodology, tool for us to make decisions. But do you really know how you decide to decide? And then anyway, getting stuff done, because I think that's the prerequisites these days of getting unstuck. By definition, that's so circular. But more importantly, being happy. And then basically, we're going to talk a little bit about risk acceptance. And then finally, things to think about in terms of our future and the future of our profession, quality. So let's dive into it. So, sign of the times. These are just a couple, what I would call memes that came up in the last couple months. One is USA's Today front page article about the doomsday clock. And another one was from the LA Times about their 2000 year storm. Unfortunately, 2 weeks later, they had another storm, the beginning of February of this year. And by the way, that should be 2024, not 2025. The point is, we're living in times of uncertainty. And the question is, how are we dealing with it? Uncertainty basically causes risk. And most of us are risk averse. In other words, we don't deal with it well. So a quick little story. A bunch of years ago, probably more than 20, Intel was building FABS in Portland, Oregon. FABS is a fabrication shop. And at that time, I was head of an economic development study for the City Club of Portland. And we were wondering, and also I was a member of IEEE, and we were wondering, what's the future of jobs in the Northwest, specifically Portland and the Northwest? And again, this was largely before the rise of Microsoft, the rise of Amazon. But anyway, we asked Gordon Moore, and you can see his picture on the right. He's one of the founders of Intel, and we asked him to give a talk for us. And Gordon, by that time, was pretty well known. And we basically asked him, Moore's Law, which basically says that the half-life of of a IC, integrated circuit, It was around 2 years, maybe 18 months. Well, that basically applied to people in their careers. He thought about it. He says, yeah, but not right now. So last couple of years, we've had generative AI. We've had all types of development. And that begs the question, how many jobs are people going to have now? So there's something called the Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, out of the federal government. And then a number of others are saying that people will have not 10 jobs anymore, but Gen Z will have up to 10 different careers. Now think about that, 10 careers. That basically means by, they graduate when they're 20, 22. They keep on working until 72, again, 50 years, not 62. Why? Well, things are, our government is going broke. Social Security is going broke. So people are going to have to work longer or not work at all. Just think about that for a second. Because of AI displacement, people may not have to work. We're going to have UBI, Universal Basic Income. So the question is, if you're going to have 10 different careers, what are you going to do with your life? Or if we don't have jobs, what are you going to do in general with all your time? So that's sort of a subtext to this talk. And that's one reason why people are stuck. People are afraid. They're seeing the same data as we're talking about, and they're wondering, what am I going to do? The point is, we're living in an age of disruption, and I'm going to be talking specifically about work disruption. So 3 years ago, we had a project called the Working at Future Work Project with Oregon State. And at the bottom of that, and I've shared this before, you can see some data. And by the way, this is before generative AI, before ChatGPT, before these new AI systems, Anyway, take a look at that. And you can see it in the red circle on the bottom of the slide. One third of the workforce will transfer to new occupations within 5 years. Again, this is before generative AI. And I think we're going to see the acceleration of this very, very quickly. So why is this happening? Well, here's a graph that I use a lot. And as you can see, we have two axes on the graph. The vertical is VUCA, acronym for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And the horizontal axis is time. And basically, in the horizontal axis, we have our personal adaptability and resilience. Basically says we don't like change. We're not adaptable. We're not resilient. Now, this graph basically is for population, but you can think of it as individuals. We don't like change. We want stability. And by the way, that's the basis of most of reliability, most quality. If you think about the fundamental tenet of quality or management systems or processes, we want systems, processes that are stable, think capable of meeting, when I mean stable, I mean statistically stable, meaning in control. And then we want systems, processes to be capable, meaning they can meet the standard. They're within the tolerance limits. In other words, they're acceptable to us. And then finally, we want systems that are minimizing variation. Again, that's the basis of all quality. That's the basis of a lot of reliability. We want stuff to last a long time. How do we do that? Through three things. One, stable systems and control. Two, capable meeting requirements. And three, minimizing variation at a target. And by the way, as people, we're in the same bucket. We want things to be stable. But there's a problem. And the problem is the vertical line that just popped up. We have external disruption, basically outside in. And again, you can think of that as AI. You can think of that as fires. You can think of that as the floods that hit LA last month in January. The 1,000-year floods that repeated themselves in 2 weeks. In other words, things are changing. That gap there is what we call the in-between place. And that in-between place between external disruption and our ability to adapt results in stuckness, like getting stuff done, unhappiness, anxiety, and fear. And what's happening is that distance, that delta between the outside in disruption and personal, our ability to change, to adapt, to be resilient, is growing. And that's causing us stuckness. And again, that gap is risk. So that's the premise of this talk and our ability to deal with uncertainty. And here's a nice little quote. I'm not going to read it, but essentially, I believe it's true. Your ability to deal with things that are uncertainty, that dealing with VUCA, essentially is a indicator of how well you're going to deal with things in life, things at work. And most of us, by the way, are very bad at it, including myself. I'm probably pretty horrible. As an example, just about 5 minutes ago, as I was preparing for this talk, simple things like which buttons to push. Fred said, "Hey, Greg, you're a Luddite." Okay, I admit it, I'm a Luddite. And he called out my daughter, "Margo, to fix this." You know, I don't like technology, even though I'm a professional engineer, I guess. So the basic premise to this talk, what we would call backstory or even subtext, is we're all VUCAns. And a VUCAN is somebody who lives in VUCA time, and we added inhabitant, N, to that. And the basic premise is we're all VUCAns. And according to Time Magazine, we can expect volatility and uncertainty increase over the next couple years. So this is a little picture of our app that we developed with Oregon State a couple years ago. Notice every app that you start with says, "Hello, world." Well, in our case, our apps was, "Hello, VUCAN." So anyway, we try to have some fun with this thing. So we're all VUCANs, and you can see how we came up with the acronym. Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and we added the N from inhabitant. So I was giving a talk about 3 weeks ago to one of the first chapters of the American Society for Quality, ASQ. It's the New Jersey, New York section. And I'm giving my talk, and I do it about every quarter, maybe every 6 months. And I just simply have some fun with them. And I was talking about the future of our profession, in this case, quality engineering. And I said, you know, it's diminishing. Maybe it won't disappear, but it's definitely changing. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm giving my talk. I'm very solemn. And the guy who's the section chair said, "Oh, yeah, I've been chair now for 4 consecutive years. And oh, by the way, we used to have 1,600 members, and now we're down to 400. So in my little mind, I did the calculation. 1,600 down to 400 basically means that one of the first sections of ASQ has lost 75% of their members. If you project that to the society at large, what does that mean? Well, ASQ, or Charter Quality Institute, probably has lost a lot of their members. And by the way, it's not only in the quality profession. It's happening in every profession, even medicine. You know, I had my yearly physical the other day, and the doctor was saying, "My profession's as a general practitioner, we're not going to have any in 10 years. So that became a big deal. So the point is, every profession is changing. And a lot of us in our profession, whatever it is, engineering, healthcare, compliance, may feel that we're stuck. And you can see that in terms of even colors. So I just bring this up as a nice little visual. Last year, let me preface this by saying every year there's a color of the year. And Pantone basically does a survey and they say, this is the color that basically exhibits society at large. Think of it as Zeitgeist. This is a nice little German word. And Zeitgeist means the spirit of the times. And Pantone 23 said the spirit following COVID was this Viva Magenta. So what's the color for 24? Well, it's sort of the cerebral peach fuzzy color that you can see on the right. It's embraced the warmth. It's getting back to personal stuff. It's things like warmth, integrity, solace, you know. But what happens is when you're in that moody color on the right, you tend to get stuck. On the other hand, if you're on the left side, you're vibrant, you're magenta. So again, it's the spirit of the times. We're moving into a time where a lot of us are becoming introspective, introverted, and quite honestly, stuck. So let's move to the critical questions that we need to ask now, and I'll provide some solutions. Clayton Christensen, the picture that just popped up, was a professor, he passed away a couple of years ago at Harvard. And he was sort of the godfather of uncertainty and disruption, wrote a bunch of books, best-selling. And he was probably the management guru, you know, just like in quality, we had Deming Juran Crosby 20, 30 years ago. Well, in general management, Clayton Christensen was the guru of uncertainty and disruption. And he asked a couple key questions 15 years ago. And the first one's, what's the meaning of your life? And the second question was, how will you measure your life? Meaning, what's the metric? What's the KPI? What's the OKR? And I think those were good questions. And largely, by the way, he was asking these questions of MBA Harvard graduates. Because, and you can see this from the two quotes, I'm not going to read these. But basically, those two questions pointed to the problem. Somebody 20, 30 years ago could graduate from Harvard with an MBA, Masters of Business Administration, and this would be like winning the lottery ticket, the golden ticket. Basically provided a roadmap to influence, wealth, public policy. Anyway, doorways would open for you. But here was the problem. A lot of the people who got the Harvard MBA 20 years ago were fundamentally unhappy. They made a lot of money, but they felt that their work, their justification, their reason for being was meaningless. And that made me wonder, where are we today? So a couple things have happened in the last 20 years. The Harvard MBA, still very prestigious, has fundamentally changed. The second thing is, getting a Harvard MBA and living in Cambridge, Mass, Massachusetts, is an investment of $110,000 a year for 2 years after taxes. So not only is there the opportunity cost, but there's actually the real cost of attending Harvard and Cambridge. So where are we today? And by the way, this is from Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago. This is data from 2023, and the share of job-seeking MBA graduates without jobs 3 months after graduation. If you look at the numbers on the right, meaning the number one, Harvard Business School and Stanford, probably the two top schools in the world for an MBA, 20% of the graduates did not have jobs. Let's look at MIT, Sloan, and Yale. Same thing. Now look at University of Michigan. Now, the top five schools are all private, running about $100,000 a year. University of Michigan, very, very practical program. Their attrition, or their number of graduates without jobs 3 months after graduation, was down in the 7%, 6% region. Now, what does that say? Well, times are changing. The golden ticket of a Harvard or Stanford MBA is a lot less than it was 20 years ago. And the result is a lot of people who are who've invested $250,000 after taxes in an MBA education are stuck. They're not going anywhere. They don't have a job. And in a larger context, it begs the question, by the way, this is from the New York Times 3 weeks ago. Unfortunately, this was the sort of the consequence and outcome of President Gay quitting her job as president of Harvard University. The prestige degree, which used to be a meal ticket for fantastic wealth, fantastic riches, no longer exists. I guess it still exists, but it's fundamentally changed. I have a number of stories because my daughter has just graduated with a degree in computer science. I've got lots of stories on that, on how even education is being disrupted for 23-year-olds. So back to our little discussion. I wanted to look at this in terms of the future of work, largely as a result of the software that we did with Oregon State University. What does it mean? One of the things that was very compelling was Oregon State University's got the biggest, maybe not the most prestigious, but it's got the biggest CS program in North America, maybe even the world. Why? Because it's online and they have people, alumni from all over the world. But as a result, looking at the future of work, especially for the younger generations, fundamentally changed. So this book that you can see on the right was the outcome of that. And we'll provide some solutions. But I believe that the three questions that are prevalent now again, Clayton Christensen asked Harvard graduates, MBA graduates, 15 years ago, those two questions. And I'm going to pose these questions that are relevant, I think, right now. And the three questions are you stuck? Are you happy? And are you meeting or achieving your goals? I think a lot of us are stuck, and I'm putting myself probably in that bucket. Fortunately, I'm content, if not happy. Why? Because I'm reaching my goals. But that's a big issue. By the way, if you're interested in this book, you can get it for $9 out of Amazon. It's very cheap. So signs of stuckness for generations. Gen Z, millennials, Gen X, and boomers all have signs of stuckness. Now, I could probably, as a boomer, I could probably talk about boomer stuckness a lot better than I could talk about Gen Z. But fortunately, due to my daughter and working with Oregon State graduates, I can understand their plight. They're getting out of school. Very difficult for them to find a good paying job, especially in high tech these days. They have to pay off exorbitant loans whose rates are variable and are going up. And they're very unhappy. So this is the things that I normally hear, and especially from Gen Zers. Now, Gen Z are folks who are probably born around 2000. So now 2024, they're around 24. So that's that cohort, that employment cohort. And these are the things that I hear a lot, especially the last one. I can't reach my dreams and goals, which might be buy a house, have a family, just simply make ends meet. So I think part of that is we're in uncertain times. And you'll say, well, every time has been uncertain. Well, let's go back maybe 100,000 years to the age of the saber tooth. And I'm going to use this as an example. And the example is, here's the story. The scenario. You got a saber-toothed tiger going to attack your village. It's going to dispose of the clan leader for sure, and maybe you. What are you going to do? What would you do? So you've got this animal on the right about to attack you. Notice the frontal teeth, much smarter than the frontal lobe. But it's going to attack you. What are you going to do? What would you do? Would you have been a hunter, meaning risk-taking? Would you have been a gatherer, being risk-averse? Because as I look at this thing, and I've talked to hundreds of people about this over the years, your proclivity, the way you see the world, your lens, is almost down at the DNA level. If you see something uncertain, like a saber tooth, what are you going to do? Are you going to run? Well, if you run, you're going to be sushi. If you fight, well, you might have a chance to scare it away. But I think our response is almost subliminal. It's down at the DNA level. It's actually a part of who we are. And again, it comes down to a risk-based decision. Do you know how you decide? Or are you reactive? Or do you simply make no decision? If no decision's made, that's a decision in itself. So back to our saber-tooth example. We know the clan leader is probably the one that's got the most meat around him or her. They're going to be the first one eaten by the tiger. So that's a foregone conclusion. But in the meantime, you know, you're somewhere in the back of the lodge. What are you going to do? Are you going to fight? Well, let's look at your options. Are you going to flee? Well, that's risk averse, meaning getting stuck or saying WTF. Are you going to freeze and on the spot and get stuck or become saber tiger lunch? Again, that's risk averse behavior. Are you going to be risk sensitive and say, okay, what's happening? What just happened? Maybe I can escape or hide under the lodge. That's risk-sensitive behavior. Or are you going to fight? Are you going to exhibit hunter behavior? Are you going to be a risk-taker? Again, this is this is an example of maybe 50,000 years ago. But again, basic issue is we have uncertainty. We have VUCA. What's your behavior? Do you know your risk appetite? Do you know what you're going to do in these circumstances? Or are you going to freeze? Freeze basically means you're going to get stuck. And you're going to be subject to the change, whatever it is. Jobs, storms, whatever. You know, you're going to be stuck. So the premise to this slide right now is risk-based decision-making is part of our DNA. So getting your stuff done, I think, or making a decision is really one of the first things that you have to do in these times of uncertainty. Again, no decision is a decision. And I think the premise to this book and to my talk and to the software we've been doing is decision-making, specifically risk-based decision-making, is the first step to becoming content, if not happy. So here's our solution. I'm not going to delve too much into it because it can get geeky pretty fast. But basically, we have a starting point. This is where you are right now. And three questions you may want to ask yourself. Who do you want to be and why? Where do you want to go and why? And what do you want to do? Why? In other words, what are your goals? Again, being in your present state, if that makes you happy, that's great. But if it doesn't make you happy, you need to do something. And you have to address those three questions. So between your starting point and your ending point, goal, you're going to have obstacles. You're going to have risks. Most of us get stuck because we don't know where we want to go. We don't know the ending point. We don't know what we want. We don't know our goal. But once you define that, then you can identify the obstacles between where you are now, your present state, and your end state, where you want to be. Every one of those obstacles you can think of as rocks in lean land, you know, in lean thinking. They used to say, okay, you got a bunch of rocks in the pond. So what you want to do is you want to get rid of the water so you can expose the rocks so you can basically remove them. In much the same way, you're going to have obstacles, risks between you and the goal. And the question is, those three questions are, how are you going to get where you want to go? What obstacles are in your way? And how are you going to remove those obstacles? Then finally, in terms of your goal, here are your three questions. How do you know you've arrived? How did you measure progress? And what did you learn in the way? So here's the basic premise and the visual for our solution. And again, we all have solutions. We have a starting point on the left. We have an ending point on the right. And during the way, we have obstacles. In this case, we have the obstacles. We can see them as little mountains or triangle, circle, and square or rectangle. And the idea is to remove those so that they become much smaller so that we can basically reach our goal. We can jump over these obstacles. That's the premise of the book. And the premise is basically risk-based. And how do you do that? How do you go from a large obstacle and making it smaller through risk-based decision-making and risk-based problem-solving? So that's the premise of the book. That's the premise of the talk. You've got a beginning point. You've got an ending point. You've got obstacles. Through risk-based decision-making, you eliminate or you minimize the obstacles so that you can reach your endpoint faster, easier, more efficiently, more economically, more effectively. So the premise, I've been giving talks for Fred for a couple months now. The premise is we're all now risk managers. Interesting point. Last year, the word of the year was permacrisis. Our word is permarisk. And the takeaway is that the risk for most personal problem solving and decision making is going to be through the lens of risk management. And basically, we're all risk managers. So a few questions to think about. I'm not going to basically spend much time on these, but these are things that are relevant to you. At this moment, what's important and meaningful to you? Are you in a fear state? Are you a resentment state? What do you think? Where are you now? Are you happy? Are you unhappy? Are you stuck? Anyway, I'll just basically go through a couple of these. When you look at evidence you're believing in, are you seeing the full picture? Do you understand your context? Are you in a fear state or expectation state? And by the way, these are all from Marsha Reynolds. I just popped up these questions. The purpose of these questions is to understand where you are right now. Are you stuck? Are you happy? Will getting unstuck or getting things done make you happier? I don't know. It's a personal decision. But all these questions are important. Why? Because they help you understand context. It helps you understand how you make decisions, how you decide how to decide. It helps you understand your risk appetite. In the time of uncertainty, are you going to sit there and be eaten by the saber tooth? Are you going to run and be eaten? Or are you going to make a decision, be risk-taking, and hopefully fight for another day? Anyway, it's a choice. Not making a decision is also a choice, meaning you accept the risk and you accept the consequences. So, final thought by G.B. Shaw. The world is populated by three kinds of Vugans. Those to whom it happens, those who wonder what happens, and those who make things happen. My goal at the end of the talk is to have you be one of those who make things happen. And the result will be you get things done and hopefully you're happier. Another way to think about it, it's better to be clued in rather than to be clueless. So anyway, many thanks for your time today. It was a rather abbreviated talk, and I'll take a couple questions.
All right. Okay. Well, Carl had a couple of them through, and I knew that you were going to touch on a bunch of them, so I didn't interrupt you. You were on a flow there. So one of them that piqued my interest is he talks about lifelong learning as a key to this, to dealing with this. It's, you focus more on the, self-assessment basically, and are you happy or not, and what are you going to do about it? But is just lifelong learning a an element of this?
Boy, absolutely. So, I don't want to say I'm a troglodyte, but let's say that I'm a boomer. And when I graduated from college, the assumption was I would have maybe three jobs through my career and have golden, silver, bronze handcuffs, because I'd spent 20 years in a company becoming a professional, being a manager, becoming a director, and hopefully even a VP sometime. Those days are gone. Maybe 10 years ago, there was, okay, you get 10 jobs. Now the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, are saying you're going to have 10 different careers. And fundamental to that means you're going to do lifelong learning. That's the subtext, if not the, hit me over the head type of epiphany.
Yeah, and when you say different career versus different jobs, it's like a whole different industry. If you were designing aircraft in one career, you do that for 5 years or so, and then you switch to polymer extrusion. So now you're, designing extruded parts for a home furnishings factory or something, and so and then you go into banking and you're, a loan agent at a bank. Completely different things that each have their own learning curves. Is that different careers? Is that what you're thinking?
Yep, exactly.
The other thing Carl brought into this was it's like never give up and just have a do it attitude, get it done. I don't know that that's true. I don't think you have to be an optimist or a pessimist. A pessimist is always stuck and an optimist is always moving forward. I think optimists can get stuck equally easily. But you have to choose to do something to move forward.
Yeah, and that choice of doing something, moving forwards, is probably the hardest thing, because we all have this self-talk, of no, I shouldn't, no, I can't, no, I won't, no, whatever, no. On the other hand, somebody who is a risk taker like me, where I keep on doing things, you've got to be, you love to be able to fail, because you fail 99% of the time until you hit it, or until you get some kudos or until you get some type of success.
Yeah, and it's not so much, I mean, the attitude, or whether it's a positive attitude or give it a try attitude, it comes with the willingness to fail. If
Yes.
that's what you're saying, right?
Yes. And the enjoyment of failure. I mean, that's sort of an oxymoron, but let me go into that. I ran track in college, and I was on a D1 team, Berkeley, Cal Berkeley. And I looked around me, and the folks down in Oakland, were running much faster than I was. Evans, Carlos, and those guys have in the whatever Olympics, I had to run against them. And they were running 4 seconds better than I was in the quarter mile. I was happy doing my PBs, my personal best. But if I and for my personal best at a California school that was single double A was great. But when I went to the next level up, running D1 against Olympic athletes, and I'm 4 or 5 seconds behind them, I was failing all the time. But again, I focused on my personal best. If
That's
you
the
ever
part
want
you
to.
could, that's the part you could control. You couldn't control who else was on the track with you that day if you didn't,
That's exactly right.
otherwise you're not in the game at all.
That's exactly right. if you're ever interested to see the greatest runners, Google Evans and Carlos per quarter mile. Their record for the 1600 meters stood for 40 years.
Yeah.
There's no way I could compete against them. You know, it's genetically twitch time, whatever. Yeah, but yeah. I'm happy just to be on the track.
That's right. Well, that reminds me, I used to do Ironman triathlons and stuff like that. And, you know, the goal wasn't to qualify to go to Hawaii. That sounded like a really brutal race.
Yeah.
You know, but to actually complete one was great. So part of the training, a group of us were all training together for this, and we went and did a half Ironman in near Sacramento. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the town. And I was almost the last out of the water. And one of my friends, he's like second out of the water. And it's a good sized field. And at the end of the race, we're having a beer and talking about our race experience and stuff. And I ended up finishing, I don't know, an hour and a half after he did. And he was, I think, 10th overall. And I was close to 10th from the end, you know, or maybe not that bad, but I was near the tail of the whole crowd. But when you're in the water, when there's nobody swimming around you, it's just a nice swim. And because everybody else took off in a big flashy, splashing, you know, kicking each other all the way through, I said, I don't want to be in that. I'll drown. I'll just swim. So I get out of the water. I get on my bike and I pass people. There's people in front of me. There's a lot of people in front of me. So I get to pass them. And every time I passed one, it felt good. And vice versa, my buddy, Ken, every time somebody passes him, because he was very early out of the water, there's very few people in front of him.
Uh-huh,
he gets passed and he feels horrible. Like, but you're an hour and a half ahead of me. It's like, but people pass me. I says, okay. So, you know, I said, next time, don't swim so damn fast. You can have more fun. We had different goals. He wanted to, you know, get a medal and win. And there's not many winners in a race like that. And so it's part of this is what you're talking about is just change your definition of what success is. And don't be sad because of what you don't have. Be happy with what you do have. It's kind of an underlying criteria.
There's that great quote about, you know, 80% of success in life is just showing up, right?
Yeah. And I think that ties into it is that you got to try. Now, Carl brought up a different one. We'll change topic here a little bit. He's saying, so you think we're in an age of disruption? And you were talking about VUCA in a little bit of a couple of slides at that time. I don't know that it's an age of disruption as much as that it's just a continuing acceleration of change. Who was the guy that did Future Shock way back in the 70s? He was talking about the pace of change is outdoing our ability to respond to it. And that was 50 years ago.
Yeah, that was in the early 70s. I forgot his name, but yeah.
Alvin Toffler.
Alvin Toffler, exactly. Right now, the change thing is basically, and this is the premise of the talk, is just simply stucking us. Is there such a word there? I think I butchered English, but it's making us stuck.
Well, it puts us in that freeze mode with your saber-tooth tiger mode. It's, you know,
yeah,
flight or fight. But there's a third option there is just freeze and not know what to do about it. I've run into people like that. I get it. So Carl talks about setting goals. But it's also, I think it's more to that because this next comment is nothing in life is worthwhile is easy. I don't know about that. Sitting out on a nice sunny day in the woods is, you know, watching the wildlife go by. That's easy to do. Just don't take your phone. But I think, and I've run into people all through my life that, you know, they make engineering look easy. They could, this guy for a project for electrical engineering made a equalizer, designed and analyzed an equalizer. that ended up getting bought, I think, by one of the audio companies because it was pretty novel and useful. And meanwhile, I'm trying to figure out how to get a light bulb to go on when I flip a switch. But he just made it look easy. It's relative, you know. What's easy for you is not easy for somebody else, and vice versa. But that's not. There is some satisfaction to doing something, and you know, finishing the schoolwork, getting the target hit, you know, finishing the race, all those kinds of things. But it's, I don't know that that's, it's easy or hard. I think there's obstacles that, you know, climbing a mountain is hard, but if you're really, really, really good at it and live in the mountains all the time and do it every day, well, it's not as hard.
Yeah. And there's a deeper thing to this. It's the messaging we give ourselves. You know, it's people that I've seen that are just simply adept at something, you know, brilliant at something. They don't often deal with adversity well, because all their life, whether it was playing the piano, whether it was running, it was easy to them. But to reach that next level, that self-talk, I think, became a big inhibitor for them. I've just seen this time after time again. If it were easy, everybody would do it. And if you've got a God-given gift, like Twitch or something like that, can you reach the next level? Because a lot of it is that self-inhibiting, self-demoralizing talk that we give ourselves. And that's tough. You know, part of it is resilience. Part of it is maturity. Part of it is upbringing. Maybe it's even genetic. I don't know.
It comes back to that being okay with failure and learning from it and moving forward. And and it, there's a balance, though, is you don't want to, you know, because you can fail like Edison 10,000 times and still not come up with a light bulb. You know, it's
like doing the same thing over 10,000 times again.
That's right. I keep doing the same thing. Yeah, there's a bunch of quotes going through my head here. but on certain times, I don't think that's any different than it has ever been. There's people that thrive on uncertainty and have the mechanisms and you know, persistence to deal with it. And there's others that don't. Yeah, we like comfort and stability in the same commute, and we get home at the same time and all that other good stuff. But it's, is that okay for you? Is that what you want? And that's the way I look at it. Let's see. I got one question here that looks like, it says, thanks a lot for the info. How do I get a recorded link to this? That's easy, is go to ascendoreliability.com/go/webinars, and I'll put that in the chat window. And it'll, I think this one will be under career in the topics listing of that stuff. And if you have trouble with that, just send me an email and I'll send you the link to it. It should be out later today, maybe tomorrow.
And I'll send you the deck later on today.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Yeah. If there are any other comments or questions, give me a holler or get hold of Fred. Maybe we'll do a podcast on that one of these days. But part of it is, this is real for a lot of people, unfortunately. And it's real for myself, for example. It's hard to learn new stuff, you know, and be able to adapt. So anyway, anything else or any other questions, comments?
Yeah, one other one here is the 7 strategies to dealing with uncertainty. I'm not sure where that's from. You know, Carl, if you have a, you come up with this, or is this from somewhere else? Is 1, don't resist. 2, invest in yourself. 3, find healthy ways to comfort yourself. 4, don't believe everything you think. I like that one. I'm good at denying what I believe. You know. next is pay attention, which is good. Some people get overwhelmed. They close the blinds and turn on YouTube and don't talk to anybody. You know, that's not healthy. Next is stop looking for someone to rescue you. Yeah, you're in this on your own. I think my dad taught me that a long time ago. find, and then the last is find meaning in the chaos, in the uncertainty. Those are all easier said than done.
And by the way, a lot of them are in the head game, in the head space.
Yep.
Unfortunately, we have the messaging of woulda, coulda, shoulda, and we tend to demoralize ourselves with that type of self-talk. And I think more and more maturity is not what you know as a professional engineer or whatever, as a software engineer. It's basically how kind you are to yourself. I would add that as part of this thing too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it looks like the ideas, Carl put up a link to a TED Talk.
Okay.
That it came from. Cool. All right. I think it's, I think we got it all. A couple of thank yous coming in.